Good morning and welcome to Community Voices. I'm John Wells and I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning is Scott Sampson, lead researcher on the Grand Staircase Escalante project that discovered a new dinosaur species related to the Triceratops named Nasutoceratops, a new dinosaur species in our favorite state, Utah. Lynn, we have got to go see this. Time for a field trip.
A field trip down to Salt Lake to look at it displayed, or do you want to just head on down to Escalante Grand Staircase?
I want to meet the actual dinosaur and interview it.
Okay, well, Scott can help us out with that one, I'm sure. Well, good morning, John. And our second guest this morning is David Biello. Now, he's the editor for Scientific American. He's assembled multiple columns to make Fact or Fiction. Science tackles 58 popular myths. So things like, did NASA really spend millions creating a pen that would write in space? Is chocolate poisonous to dogs? Does stress cause gray hair? And we really have to follow up on that one, John. No reason in particular. These questions are just a sample of the urban lore investigated in this book, Fact or Fiction, Science Tackles 58 Popular Myths. He'll be joining us in the second half of the hour. You're listening to Community Voices on KPCW right here in Park City. We'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
The Egyptian Theater and the Neil Simon Festival present Lost in Yonkers, a play by Neil Simon, August 15th through the 18th. The New York Daily News called this one of Simon's most impressive and funniest plays. It's touching and poignant, clever and witty. Tickets start at just $23 and are available at parkcityshows.com or 649-9371. The Egyptian Theater is a dramatically different nonprofit organization.
And welcome back to Community Voices. Our first guest, Scott Sampson, is a dinosaur paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, and science communicator. His research focuses on the ecology and evolution of the late Cretaceous period, and he's conducted fieldwork in Kenya, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Madagascar, Mexico, and our home state of Utah. Sampson is currently serving as the head researcher on a large-scale project at the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southern Utah, which has yielded abundant remains of a previously unknown assemblage of dinosaurs. Scott, we're pleased to have you with us this morning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, John and Lynn. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Oh. You know, Lynn and I were spending some time this morning looking at dinosaur pictures. Before we talk about your work, can we all just agree that this new species is not going to be winning any beauty contests?
Well, even the name Nasutoceratops means big nose, horn face, which sounds like an insult you'd hurl at somebody. But in fact, it's quite descriptive. This thing does have an amazing oversized nose, giant horns over the eyes to project to the front of the face, and this big bony frill out the back of the skull. So yeah, it's a face only a mother could love, probably.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe an appropriate name might be the Jimmy Durantosaurus.
Yeah, we've been joking about that, too, the giant schnoz, although that's a joke that I found only a certain generation gets.
Right.
Uh-oh. What's that saying there?
That says a lot. Okay. Well, tell us about your work.
Well, I was previously at the University of Utah, at the Natural History Museum there, and also in the Geology and Geophysics Department. In 2000, I started a project down in Grand Staircase to investigate these badlands that date to the end of the Age of Dinosaurs, a time period known as the Late Cretaceous. And at that point, I mean, Grand Staircase is this vast expanse of really rugged terrain that was the last area in the lower 48 to be mapped because everyone just went around it. And even today, in almost 2 million acres, there's just a handful of roads. So it's a really interesting place.
So, Scott, I'm wondering why there are such huge concentrations in a couple of different areas in southern Utah. I, you know, of course, the one that you're talking about, Grand Staircase, And then I've heard of another one to the north of Arches National Park. What happened to the dinosaurs that made them sort of concentrate and gather in these places and then all die?
Well, it's really more geological serendipity. It has nothing to do so much with where the animals lived. There were dinosaurs all over North America for most of the age of dinosaurs. So they're buried under New York City, you know, somewhere. But the thing is, in Utah, the rocks have been uplifted and they're eroding so that paleontologists can go down there and literally discover them at the surface. And that's what's happened in Grand Staircase and near Arches and Cleveland Lloyd and Dinosaur National Monument, places like that.
Okay, so that is to say that if the geology were right in any given area, maybe any just about anywhere in this state, you would find concentrations of dinosaurs, dinosaur fossils.
That's right. Unless the rocks have been eroded away from above, which has happened in a few places, you would find dinosaurs there. That's true.
Okay. So about the, and how do you say the word? Is it Nasutoceratops?
Pretty good. Nasutoceratops is the way we say it. So the Nasuto is the big nose and the ceratops is the horn face. And it's got a second part of its name in the same way we have two names and there's Homo sapiens and Tyrannosaurus rex. Nasutoceratops, the last name is Titusi, named after Alan Titus, the paleontologist in Grand Staircase, who has been a tremendous asset to us over the years, both in taking care of logistics and actually finding and digging up dinosaurs.
Can you tell us the difference between ecology and evolution and why we should be studying them in a unified theme?
Wow, I love that question. That's terrific. Ecology basically is the study of how things interact in any moment in time. Most often we talk about the present day, but there is paleoecology that looks at moments in deep time. Evolution is change through time. So we can think of ecology almost as like a horizontal axis and evolution as a vertical axis. And really, you have to combine the two to get an understanding of any particular place. You have to understand, to really get an understanding of any place, you need to know how it works, where the energy comes from, how it flows through there, where wastes go to, etc., where water comes from. And you have to know the story of that place, how it came to be, the land forms, the life, and everything. And so ecology and evolution are often considered as separate entities to be studied, but really nature doesn't recognize that. They are a unified whole.
Well, this seems to be a common theme that Lynn and I have conversations about with past guests where we're now finding more instances of collaborative research by different types of things: chemistry, biology, physics. Now you're talking about ecology and evolution. There's more collaborative efforts of dissimilar studies that are coming together and yielding results.
Boy, you're just coming up with all the great questions. I love this. You're exactly right. And I think traditionally paleontology was a study where you went out and you dug up big, cool things and you put them on exhibit in museums. And we've really moved away from that, particularly in the past sort of 10 to 20 years. And the project in Grand Staircase is a perfect example. We have not just paleontologists working on the project, but geologists, people who work on plants, fishes, turtles, lizards, mammals. We have people who are interested in climate. So we're putting all these different ologies together to really try and reconstruct an ancient ecosystem and understand how it came to be. And we sort of joke about this as total paleontology with all these different disciplines involved. But I think this is the future of paleontology, that most major fields in the natural sciences go through this phase. The first phase is stamp collecting, where you're just trying to figure out what's out there, and then it becomes more integrative later on. And I think paleontology has now reached that stage.
Well, I'm fascinated about these different disciplines coming together in a collaborative way. It's just very exciting, I think, for the future as other types of disciplines take on this similar approach. I'm curious, with all the different disciplines you have working on this, do you have an artist also working with you?
We actually work with multiple artists. which is terrific. When you're reconstructing ancient animals, there's obviously a certain element of creativity involved. You only have so much to work from, typically hard tissues, bones and teeth. So when you're reconstructing muscles and skin and color and feathers and all that, you really need an artist's touch and ability. And we work with multiple different artists. I'd also like to point out that people often say, well, why study stuff that's been dead for millions of years, other than the fact that kids might be fascinated by it, and adults too. But I think one of the things that's coming out of this integrative approach is that we're now thinking about the future. So right now our planet is warming up pretty fast, and in 100 years we may have a global climate that resembles that of the age of dinosaurs, a hothouse world instead of an ice house world. And we haven't experienced that for many, many millions of years, so we can't look to the present day to understand how ecology and evolution operate in a hothouse world. To get to that, we have to look back to ancient ecosystems like those in the late Cretaceous, and that's what we're trying to do. So ironically, studying things in the deep past may actually help us understand where we're going in the future.
And that was exactly my question, Scott, but is it common wisdom and commonly accepted among those entities that fund paleontology that this is, you know, that it's there for more than entertainment of children when you find a new dinosaur?
I think it is becoming more and more aware that organizations like the National Science Foundation, that funds a lot of research nationally in the United States, is really looking for integrative types of programs now. They're very focused, of course, on climate and programs related to that. But it's been difficult because when you have people reviewing proposals, they are experts in only one field, and if they don't understand the other fields, it's easy for them to question things. So it's actually difficult to get proposals funded that are very integrative for this reason. But I think more and more people are realizing that this is the wave of the future, that the old way of doing things just isn't going to get us where we need to go.
Ah, very good. Our guest is Scott Sampson. He led the team that discovered the Nasutoceratops in the Grand Staircase Escalante area. And I have so many questions, but one of them is, I don't remember if you were on the panel, Scott, when Ira Flato and Science Friday came to Salt Lake City back in the spring.
No, that was Randy Ermus, a paleontologist who actually replaced my position at the University of Utah, and I believe Randy was the person on the panel. I did speak with Ira just like a week or so ago about Nasutoceratops.
Yes, okay, I did hear that. Okay, so at this panel, the thing that most fascinated me was Ira Flato was such a smart guy to take all these questions from the audience, and there would be children that would come up, and you know, there were five different topics or so, but one of them, of course, was paleontology. And the children would ask the most amazing questions about dinosaurs. And one of those, I just thought, where do these kids get this knowledge, first of all? But everyone was so passionate about their questions. But one of those was the disappointment, I mean profound disappointment, over the fact that Brontosaurus didn't actually exist. Is this... Talk about that, which dinosaurs maybe didn't exist, and why is that when you find fossils?
Lynn was crushed.
Well, in some respects, you could argue that Brontosaurus existed. It's just that it didn't have the right name.
Okay.
So the animal that we called Brontosaurus existed. It's just that there were different parts of the animal found at different times, and they were both given names. So when we realized that this was the case, we had to go with the first name that was ever ascribed to that animal, and that was Apatosaurus, not Brontosaurus. So Brontosaurus was still around.
Okay, just incorrectly named, so features maybe, if you don't recover certain fossils that show certain features, they may be incorrectly named.
Right. But I need to point out, Lynn, you are exactly right. I serve as the host of this PBS kids show called Dinosaur Train, and millions of kids know me as Dr. Scott, the paleontologist. So I go around the country and I speak to these kids all the time, and I am continually blown away by their level of knowledge. And I regularly amaze audiences by showing, for example, a picture of a dinosaur, and I ask how many adults know the name, and three or four hands go up, and then I say how many kids know, and hundreds of hands will go in the air, and I'll say, okay, everyone name it, and they'll all scream out at the same time, Parasaurolophus, and all the adults' jaws drop because they thought their kid was the only one that would know this stuff. So kids really do love dinosaurs. It's a opportunity for them to learn things that adults don't know, often the first opportunity in their lives, and they're engaged with these animals because, of course, they're monsters, they're bizarre, and they're extinct, so they're not going to come out from underneath the bed to get them.
There are few things that are more fascinating to children, it seems. Maybe, you know, a fire truck's pretty fascinating, but dinosaurs are so fascinating, and I'm sure you get the question all the time how you worked your, you know, these kids, of course, want to grow up to be paleontologists. So what do you tell? What's your story about how you got into paleontology?
Well, it's probably pretty typical of a lot of people who do this. There aren't that many dinosaur paleontologists on the planet, you know, a couple of hundred max, 150 probably more likely. And so all these kids are not going to grow up to be paleontologists, and that's just fine, but I always encourage them to go after their passion, and if their passion really is dinosaurs, to go for it. I grew up with a passion for nature. I was introduced to dinosaurs by the age of 4, and I developed this major passion for them. My mother used to tease me about it all the time. Without exaggeration, paleontology is one of the first words I learned how to spell, so I was a geek from a very young age. And I just never lost that passion, and I considered doing other things, but I found my way back to dinosaurs. And I think in part, though, it was because I spent so much time outside in nature, and I had spent a lot of time camping, and, you know, as a paleontologist, you travel to these distant places, and you live in rugged environments and stuff, so you have to be willing to deal with those types of conditions. And one of the crises of today, of course, is that most kids are spending all their time indoors. They spend an average of 4 minutes a day outside, which is 90% less than their parents. So we're losing this connection with the natural world that spawned scientists like me.
Oh, very good.
Scott, I have a question about the chronology of all of this. And you know, a lot of people believe that there was a singular event, an asteroid that put our planet into nuclear winter, and that was basically what contributed to the extinction of the dinosaurs. And that was roughly, what, 65 million years ago?
Yep, a little probably closer to 66 now, but yep, exactly.
So the question that I have is, during that period, which I believe was Jurassic, you had a whole bunch of dinosaurs that were roaming the planet. And before that period was the Cretaceous period, which is the period that you study. Is that correct?
Actually, the Cretaceous comes after the Jurassic, right at the very end of the Mesozoic, and that is the period that I study the most.
Okay. Between these periods, and let's say there's a 10 million year gap between a period or some of these periods, what happened to the existing dinosaurs in that period? Did they become extinct, or did they just evolve?
Yeah, there's a great question. So we do talk about the dinosaurs going extinct 65 to 66 million years ago. And, of course, they didn't really go extinct because birds are dinosaurs. They are the direct descendants of dinosaurs. So there's more dinosaurs around today than there are mammals because all birds are dinosaurs. But the reality is that even the big dinosaurs, most of them did not go extinct 65 or 66 million years ago. Most of them had already gone extinct. So dinosaurs were around for on the order of 170 million years. They came and go in various times. So at every time period, Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous, we find different kinds of dinosaurs. And some of those kinds evolved into new forms, which persisted all the way through even to birds. Many of them are lineages that just went completely extinct, and they were dead ends, so to speak. Now, that's a negative way of looking at it because they were around for a long time and served important roles on the planet. But you're exactly right. Dinosaurs went extinct basically multiple times. It's just that there were always survivors. And the thing about the big KT event, as it's called 66 million years ago, is that all the big dinosaurs went extinct. There were no survivors, and the only thing that made it through amongst the dinosaurs were the birds.
Okay. Well, thank you. Great answer. Scott, as a dinosaur paleontologist and as an evolutionary biologist, what singular question would you like to have answered in your lifetime? If there's one question you'd like to have answered before you go, what would it be?
Wow. The question, I think, would have to be, and this is one of the things that I'm working on right now with my research, is how did ecology and evolution work in a hothouse world. And I think it's a pressing question for us that climate change is one of the most pressing issues of our time, and we need to understand how that works. So, for example, if there is a major extinction, which we could be heading towards, I mean, there's some scientists argue that before the end of this century, half the species currently alive may go extinct. So that definitely qualifies as a mass extinction. It hasn't happened since the extinction of the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. So how long does it take for the world's ecosystems or the biosphere to recover? And there are some arguments that it takes 4 million years. There are some arguments that it takes much, much less than that. And I'm interested in that. How does ecology work when the planet's much warmer? Right now, the highest biodiversity is at equatorial regions, but it might be that in a hothouse world with more carbon dioxide, we get super high diversity of plants and animals at temperate latitudes. And so we're interested in exploring some of these questions and seeing what the fossil record has to tell us. But we're still a long ways off from getting firm answers.
That's just another response that you've had, Scott, that shows the importance really of paleontology and how we can relate the past to the present, you know, in such a coherent way.
Absolutely. And I would say for the general public, the real role of paleontology is that it helps to inject us in the story of us. We often talk about dinosaurs as if they existed on another planet, but they were part of our past. If the dinosaurs weren't here, we wouldn't be here right now. It was not just the extinction of the dinosaurs that allowed mammals to take off. Dinosaurs co-evolved with everything that was around at the time, including flowering plants, which have driven land ecosystems ever since the Cretaceous. So we need to understand this deep time story of us so that we have a sense of where we're heading. In other words, you got to know where you've been before you know where you're going. And most people have today don't really have that sense of history. We're arguably the only culture in human history that doesn't have a cosmology, an origin story. That, yes, if you follow a major religion, you have an origin story, but most people in Western society no longer do. And so we live in this moment of time called the present, and we don't really relate to any deep time story as indigenous peoples around the world have for over, you know, 200,000 years. So we need to get that story, and science offers us an amazing story that most people just don't know. And I think dinosaurs offer this great vehicle to enter the universe story, or the great story, as many people call it.
Scott, how do you respond to someone who says that we've only been around for 6,000 years? I mean, it's a naive question in a way, but I don't really know how scientists like you tackle that one.
Yeah. So if most people I find who come to me and they say, you were wrong, the Earth is only 6,000 years old, there's nothing I'm really going to say to change their mind in my experience. So I can talk to them about the science, about all the fossils, about the rock record, the fact that rocks take millions of years to form and erode, and all these things. And if your belief system is based on the Bible and that's your bottom line, then the rest of it really is noise. So I don't worry too much about trying to, you know, convert folks who are young Earth creationists. They have a right to their beliefs, just as I do mine. And my role as a scientist is to try and communicate the science and let people take their beliefs where they want to take them.
Very good. Okay. So now, in the past 13 years, I think it is, you say there have been 20 new dinosaurs found in Utah alone. Is that right?
Actually, it's more than that. That 20 just comes from Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument.
Oh, wow.
And there are workers working in other areas and other time periods that have found dinosaurs as well. And this is one of the key points that I always point out to kids, is that we often think that everything that's out there to be found has been found, and there's going to be nothing for these kids to find when they grow up. But the reverse is true. There have been more dinosaurs found in the past generation than in all prior history, and the rate of discovery is not slowing down. So there's going to be plenty of new animals for the next generation and future generations of paleontologists to discover.
So those kids just can't wait to get out of elementary school and right into college.
There you go.
Scott, in Salt Lake City at the university and the entire state of Utah, where are the best places for people to go to see these remains, to learn more about dinosaurs, to learn more about paleontology?
Boy, if you want to learn about dinosaurs, you tough tough time finding a better place than Utah. Of course, the Natural History Museum of Utah, an amazing new building in Salt Lake City with wonderful exhibits of paleontology, including much of the fauna, that is the new discoveries from Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And if you're interested in seeing dinosaurs sort of in the field, you can go to Dinosaur National Monument. There's the Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry. If you Google the dinosaur triangle, it'll come up with a number of different sites that people can go to that relate to, you know, the Mesozoic world of dinosaurs. So it's a great state to go looking for dinosaurs in.
Okay. And I also wanted to mention, and correct me if I'm wrong, as far as the Nasutoceratops discovery, I believe that Eric Lund, who was doing his master's work at the University of Utah, he really drove that, didn't he?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. It's an actually remarkable story, and the only example of this that I know of in paleontology. Eric discovered this animal. He led the dig site where it was excavated. He then oversaw it being, you know, exported or transported out of there. He prepared the skull of this animal and the specimen in the lab, and then he worked on it for part of his master's degree. It was the centerpiece sort of a lot of his work. And so Eric did a lot of the research that relates to this animal, and I don't know of anybody else who's sort of taken it from that moment of discovery to contributing so directly to the research.
Oh, that's excellent. So speaking of that, it's now at the Nasutoceratops is on display now at the History of what's it called?
Natural History Museum of Utah.
Thank you. And just an incredibly beautiful building. And so it's on display, but what does that mean about when it was actually discovered and extracted? I mean, that process is very long, right? And all the lab work it takes?
Yeah, a lot of people think that paleontologists go out in the hill and they discover something and they get out the satellite phone and call CNN. And really, it's typically years between the moment of discovery and the moment of announcement. You have to dig it up. We have to get a helicopter to airlift it out of the Badlands, drive it to the museum. Preparators, typically volunteers with the patience of saints, literally, prepare these specimens, sometimes for years on a single specimen. Then it has to be studied, researched, compared with other specimens around the world. You need to write the paper, submit it to a journal, has to go through review, acceptance, etc. So that whole process typically takes years.
Scott, this has been a fascinating conversation. We want to thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, John and Lynn, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
All right.
Scott Sampson, dinosaur paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, and science communicator.
And you're listening to Community Voices. Stay with us. We'll be back. We're speaking with David Biello. He is an editor at Scientific American. He'll be talking about his new book. He's edited Factor Fiction, Science Tackles 58 Popular Myths. Stay with us.
Tune in to Minor Details on Saturday nights from 7 to 8 on KPCW. Join Lyndon Quill and Annika Simos while they talk about Park City High School news, updates, sports, and play music.
Did you know that it was considered bad luck for a woman to work underground in the mines? This is Hope Woodside with your weekly Park City History Bit. It wasn't until 1974 that the first woman worked in a Park City mine, and the one who led the way was Shelley Christensen. She was hired to operate a hoist 1,500 feet below the surface. As a divorced mother of two young boys, she needed a better-paying job than being a nurse's aide at a rest home in Heber. Shelley came from a mining family. Her grandfather, father, and brother all worked underground, so following the family business was a logical solution. A year later, the mines hired two more women, Rita Smith and Doris LaFay. Unfortunately, their careers in mining were short-lived, as well as those of their 350 male co-workers, when they were all laid off in 1978.
This Park City History Bit is brought to you by the Park City Museum, where you can explore Park City history every day on Main Street. Sponsored by Julie Hopkins of Keller Williams Real Estate.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Music. And welcome back to Community Voices. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, our next guest is David Biello. He is an editor at Scientific American. He edits a column about scientific myths, fact or fiction. And he's now edited a new book called Fact or Fiction, Science Tackles 58 Popular Myths. So it draws from Scientific American's column and, oh, Fact or Fiction, and also the Strange but True columns. And they have selected some of the most surprising, fascinating, useful, and just plain wacky topics confronted by their writers over the years. And David Biello, welcome to Community Voices.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. And I guess I want to start by asking you, David, I know you're a scientist because I've seen other articles of yours that are hard science. And so it makes me wonder about how a scientist looks at certain things that have popped up that seem pretty mythical, and, you know, how you look at them and how you consider them and how you dispel them or not.
Well, first of all, I'm not a scientist. I just play one on the radio, apparently. I'm a science journalist. I've been covering primarily energy and the environment for about 15 years now. But to answer your question, usually we're doing stories that are pretty hard science, whether it's, climate change or nuclear power or things of that nature, where kind of things, it's pretty clear what's known and not known. But every once in a while, it's more fun to do something that's a little more speculative. The world is a pretty surprising place, and sometimes we get some pretty bad information out there. So it's fun to kind of see what some of those, the technical term is old wives' tales, whether they have any validity or not. So, for example, I grew up in Missouri, which is part of Tornado Alley, mm-hmm. And spent a lot of time, tinkering in the basement from tornadoes. And the old adage was, if the sky turns green, you better get underground because a tornado is coming. And guess what? That is very good advice. If the sky turns green, you definitely want to head for cover.
Ah, I like that. So there are old wives' tales that we can take as hard science. And I'm wondering, I mean, how often does it happen that one of these quirky, you know, unbelievable things turns out to be hard science? I mean, I think as a nation, we've been exposed to it through Mythbusters. My kids love
yep.
that show. And so some of the things, when they start off, you don't know how it's going to turn out, if it's going to be a myth or if it's going to be hard science.
That's right. It's definitely true that our ancestors had a lot of wisdom that maybe we don't give them credit for. They might not have been using, the latest technology or whatever, but they had a pretty good sense of what was going on in the natural world around them. So oftentimes, like with the sky turns green, run for cover because a tornado is coming. If it has to do with the natural world, then the old advice is often good advice.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes where it falls down a bit is more in kind of the health realm,
right.
or even what we'd call the physics realm. So, for example, some of the old remedies may not be so great for you. And then there are other cases where, we may have been kind of deliberately fooled by the wording of certain products. So, for example, I wrote a column about whether premium gasoline delivers premium benefits to your car. It certainly sounds like it, since it's called premium gasoline. You'd think it'd be better for just about any car. But it turns out that really, unless your car is specifically manufactured to only use premium gasoline, you don't need to spend the extra money to pump that kind of gasoline in. You will get the same performance from conventional or, regular gasoline. So why not save the money?
It's amazing how these myths have become so popular, and there's so many that everybody in the country seems to hold dear. You know, chocolate is poisonous to dogs. Don't touch a baby bird because the mother will abandon it. It's just amazing how these myths move around from generation to generation across a large country and the world.
Yeah, it's true. And one of my favorite parts of this particular column is when readers write in with their own questions. So, for example, you mentioned, touching a baby bird. That actually came from a reader who I'm guessing was probably dealing with a baby bird situation in their backyard, and maybe their child had found the baby bird that had fallen down from the tree, and they didn't want to do something that was gonna kind of harm that bird's chances of survival. That it's kind of fun to answer those questions, and certainly there are questions that are endemic to particular regions. So my tornado question, that's probably more prevalent in the Midwest, whereas some other things might be more prevalent on the East Coast and the West Coast. One of my favorite examples from the East Coast is folks who kind of wander along the beach and come upon this mass, potentially stinky mass of what looks like garbage from the sea, and it turns out that's actually whale vomit, and it turns out that is a very valuable substance because it is put into kind of high-end perfumes, and if you find that, it's like winning the lottery.
Yeah, and it's not actually vomit, though. It's the substance is excreted.
That's right. That's right. You're right. I kind of spoke a little too colloquially there.
I'm paying too much attention to your book.
No, that's good. That's good.
I put a couple of items on the table. I might as well address them quickly.
Sure.
First of all, chocolate, it's not necessarily poisonous to dogs. And before you comment on that, let me just address the other one, and that birds do not abandon their young when they are touched.
That's right. That's right. So it's not a total taboo, and you can often help rescue a baby bird by lifting it up back into its nest. And then with the chocolate and the dogs, it comes down to kind of how big is your dog and how much chocolate are you feeding it. You certainly don't want to give a chihuahua, 20 pounds of M&Ms, but it won't instantly kill your dog as some people seem to think.
Now, it's interesting, David, that also sort of in the front flap or cover of your book, you talk about stress and gray hair, but I have to tie dogs into this. I have this wonderful dog who became prematurely gray, and it absolutely coincided when I started working 50 hours a week and could not be around this dog as much as I normally had. And he wasn't gray at all before then. His brother up the street is not gray. So I love the dog tie-in, and it's a big dog community here in Park City, Utah. So, what about stress to dogs and gray hair in general?
Well, I can't speak for dogs. So maybe that, that's another one, but it seems that stress, while often correlated with gray hair, is not necessarily responsible for gray hair. And, anecdotally, I would tend to believe that one too, because right after I had kids, I started to go gray. But that also probably has a lot to do with how old I was when I had kids, and things like not getting enough sleep anymore with a newborn and that kind of thing. So it turns out that you can probably deal with a little bit of stress and not go gray.
That's right. Okay, and coincidentally, a couple weeks ago, there I was in my beautiful Mediterranean vacation, swimming along in the clear, blue, warm waters, when,
ouch,
I was stung by a jellyfish. Now, it's about 2.5 weeks later, and this thing is going to scar big time. And I'm thinking, yeah, it was really, really painful. It hadn't happened since I was a young kid, and I realized that I had some PTSD over it because it really hurts and you feel this panic. But should I have had someone you-know-what on me?
Well, we have to tell the people you-know-what.
We're talking about urination.
Yeah, that's right. It can help you in that situation. So might have wanted to consider that a little bit. But really, you don't need to take a quick trip to the bathroom. Your best bet is to try to avoid the jellyfish in the first place. Of course, I'm sure you would have done that if you could have.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So it would be like the uric acid or something, because I think vinegar also, acidic thing, helps that, as helps a jellyfish sting as well.
Exactly. As the more that you can kind of whisk that venom away with acid, which is also in your waste, the better off you'll be. I'm not sure it will help with the scarring.
Okay.
You know, of all these myths, the one that always bugged me, and I didn't have any scientific data to back up my distaste for this, but this whole Mozart effect always bugged me. All these parents just hovering around doing all these weird things because they think that they're going to help their children compete in a competitive world 20 years from now. Can you talk about the Mozart effect?
Well, so this is the idea that if you play your baby classical music, that baby will, grow up to be a genius. And unfortunately, that is not the case. Although, interestingly enough, reading to your baby, that is the way to go. There is a strong correlation there. So not so much on the Mozart, but definitely on the Dr. Seuss.
Mm. Yeah, and as you mentioned in your book, the real danger, it's not the irresponsible marketers that are providing products that Mozart's tapes that you play to the fetus, but it's the parents that want to shirk their responsibilities by maybe not being as, maybe they should be reading their children a book versus, throwing on a tape of music and thinking that's going to take care of business.
Headphones.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. It all comes down to parental involvement. You can think that you're, kind of buying yourself some free time by playing these Mozart CDs, and lo and behold, your kid will do well in math. But that is definitely not the case. The only way to help with that is to actually, get involved and read to your kid, or I don't know, do math problems with your kids.
There you go. Our guest is David Biello. He is an editor at Scientific American. He's an editor of a couple columns. Is it a couple columns? It's Fact or Fiction and also The Strange But True?
It was a couple columns, but Strange But True turned out to kind of overlap too much with Fact or Fiction, so we just made it all Fact or Fiction.
Into one. Okay, very good. So I want to go back, David, to something you said earlier. And you said a lot of the sort of scientific wives' tales surrounding the natural world turn out to be, they can be more true than some in some of the other realms, one of those being health and the other being physics. And I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you delved into any of these specific myths in the book, but quantum physics, is that kind of what you're talking about?
Oh, well, I don't know that there are any old wives' tales about quantum physics, because that one is, I don't think anybody kind of expected that one, maybe, 50 to 100 years ago. That was kind of a big surprise. But I am all ears if you have some old wisdom about quantum physics.
Well, I guess I was just referring to, and I don't, but well, actually, the is it called the 100th monkey? I think that has to do with quantum physics, where they did some research on monkeys on different completely isolated islands, and they started to do things that were evolutionarily the same, while having no contact at all. And they were sort of chalking that up to being quantum physics in some, way down the line.
Huh. I actually haven't heard that one, so this is great. This is another kind of reader write-in moment.
There you go.
I think
we'll have to look into that one. But that one actually sounds a lot more like what's known as convergent evolution.
Okay.
That's the idea that, kind of the same creature, or two different creatures, actually. So, say a monkey and an armadillo in two different parts of the world can end up evolving kind of the same response if they are exposed to the same environmental pressures. Whether that's, let's say, a highway crossing, mm-hmm. so they suddenly And this is actually happening to swallows in the Midwest, so that they have to get out of the way of traffic, and they'll evolve kind of similar speed mechanisms to deal with that.
Okay, so convergent evolution or adaptation.
I actually remember reading about the 100th monkey, and it was that this particular type of monkey across the world always ate its sweet potato a certain way. And all of a sudden in Japan, this one monkey, sort of the alpha male, decides that that he's going to wash his sweet potato in salt water before he eats it. It makes it easier for some reason. He starts doing it, and everyone else in his little local tribe starts doing it. And then immediately, like 4 or 5 months later, 5,000 miles away, monkeys start going down to the ocean and washing their sweet potatoes in salt water. So it's one of those things.
Interesting. I'll definitely have to look into that. It sounds, a sweet potato with a little salt. That sounds tastier.
Very good. So, David, do you have any, sort of favorite myths of the 58 that you just think are hilarious or enlightening or, anything, any standouts?
Well, I think, some of the classics from my childhood and maybe early adulthood are the ones that really stood out to me, because I definitely, going through grade school was concerned about swallowing my gum because I knew that it was just going to be kind of with me forever. And I was right. don't swallow your gum. It's kind of hard to break down.
How long does it take?
Well, it depends. No one has done the actual scientific studies to find out exactly how long. 7 years is probably was probably the number that people came up with, because it is seems like an excessively long amount of time. But honestly, the gum is going to kind of pass through your system in other ways rather than being broken down. But with you for a long time, so don't get that big ball of gum in your stomach. Another one that I liked is the fact that black holes sing. You don't think of interstellar phenomenon being musical, but there is a kind of Mozart effect for black holes. And if you go to the right websites and whatnot, you can actually hear a black hole sing.
Wow. How about that? How about when that James Webb telescope that they're building down in the Salt Lake area, when they send that a million miles into space, maybe they can some good sound recordings.
There you go.
Yeah, very good. And back to the Mozart effect, you might be better served by getting your kindergartner to start that gum experiment, so that when they're a senior, they can go back, and it could be a science project for them, and they can prove if there's no data out there about gum and how long it takes to digest. There you go.
Yep, it's that. There you go. It's a science fair winner, right?
Yeah.
It's both fun to do, and you'd be contributing to the advancement of science.
I've heard for years, and everybody else has, that a cockroach can survive a nuclear holocaust, and you have a piece in your book which is fascinating about cockroaches being able to survive a beheading.
Yes. Cockroaches are really quite incredible creatures. They can survive for a while without their head, thanks to the fact that they have a kind of rudimentary nervous system that, can kind of the kind of brain functions are housed in the body. So it can kind of do its thing for a while. Of course, eventually you need a mouth to eat with, so the cockroach isn't going to survive forever. And the good news is, cockroaches would probably survive a nuclear war, but they wouldn't last long without us, unfortunately. Cockroaches are actually tropical bugs, and they need our nice, warm, heated homes and buildings to survive in. So once we were gone, they would quickly retreat back to places like Florida, where they are natives.
With the phenomena of the internet, how's Scientific America doing with its hard copy publication?
Well, actually, this book is one of our novel strategies for coping with these new challenging times. We're putting out these ebooks, kind of compilations of past material, whether it's the fact or fiction column or kind of everything that's ever been written in Scientific American about the dawn of flight. Many people don't know this, but Scientific American is the oldest continuously published magazine in the United States since 1845, actually.
Wow, didn't know that.
And we had a prize for developing airplane flight that, of course, the Wright brothers won. And we've been covering scientific developments in this country and around the world for a very long time. So you can imagine that we can pull together these kind of fascinating historical accounts about the development of various sciences, whether it's flight or the physics of nuclear bomb. There have been a number of these ebook projects, and so far they seem to have been pretty popular. And obviously, that's a new thing for a magazine that was traditionally printed on paper and delivered to your mailbox.
And, I wanted to say, David, that on my way to getting stung by the jellyfish, I was in the airport, and John and I are sort of switching up the format of this show. It's going to be called Cool Science Radio, beginning Labor Day, and we're going to be talking about more stuff like this, like we are. So I went into the bookstore there at the airport, and looking for a science publication, and Scientific American was the one. So it is, the most notable publication.
Excellent. I'm glad you were able to find it. I always try to look for it in the airport too. And of course, we are obviously still putting out the print magazine that you can pick up at your local airport or subscribe to. But we also have these ebooks, which you can buy, and of course our website, where the daily science news is available to all and sundry online visitors.
Well, increasingly, it's a complicated world, and my sense is there's a resurgence in interest in science and technology to try to make sense of all of this. And is that your sense as well?
I certainly hope so for my job security. No, but seriously, I agree with you that science is only becoming more important to kind of coping with some of the challenges of the modern world. Unfortunately, sometimes people feel a little bit intimidated by science, thinking that's just for nerds or brainiacs, but it's for all of us. And hopefully, things like fact or fiction can show how science has sometimes fun applications to everybody's daily life.
And that's what we're going to attempt to do on Cool Science Radio. If we can understand it, then our listeners will be able to understand it. So we're looking forward to that.
Excellent. I wish you all the luck in the world.
Well, thank you. And same to you. Our guest, David Biello, is an editor at Scientific American. He's got the new book out, the ebook, Fact or Fiction, Science Tackles 58 Popular Myths. And David, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Again, David Biello. You're listening to Community Voices right here on KPCW. We'll be right back.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Summer's here.
So we're out of the
Summer's where? Wait, Janet's here?
Uh-oh. Don't tell anybody about Park City's summer secrets.
It's a secret? But John, isn't that our job, telling Park City who's got savory summer snacks and where the sizzle and fun is?
Secrets out for summer. Find out what all the cool kids are up to this summer. Tune in to Fun Friday at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by
All Seasons Adventures,
Park Silly Sunday Market,
Zermatt Resort and Spa,
and the Homestead Resort.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur features live music, cocktails, and Southern Pub Grub every evening starting at 3 p.m. Our website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information. You must be 21 years or older to enter.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional, FHA, and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
It's KPCW Park City. Thanks for listening today. And thanks to our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Albion Financial, Prudential Utah Real Estate, 350 Main, and the Spur Bar and Grill, and Zions Bank. Here's NPR News.